The views and discussion expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of the hosts of the program, WMKV, Maple Knoll Communities, WLHS, the Lakota Local School District, or staff and management. The information and advice presented are educational in nature and not intended to be taken as specific legal, accounting, or other professional advice. Always consult with your own legal, accounting, or other professional before making any investment. Welcome to Real Life Real Estate Investing, a show to help you gain financial freedom by investing in real estate. Brought to you by the Real Estate Investors Association of Cincinnati and the Ohio Real Estate Investors Association. You're listening to Real Life Real Estate Investing on WMKV, WLHS, and the Maple Knoll Radio Network. And now your host, Vina Jones Cox.
Hello. Well, I am not Vina Jones Cox, but I am Scott Ellsworth. Happy to guest host tonight. Just want to make sure that all the investors out there are ready for a great hour with us. So let me get started. One, if you have any questions during the session, call 877-772-9658, or you can email vinaradio@gmail.com, and we'll try to get those questions answered. So our guest tonight is Mark Halpern, and he has been an active investor, and now he has sort of transitioned over to being a passive investor. Mark, how are you doing tonight?
Very good, Scott. Thank you very much for having me here.
Oh, it is great to hear from you. Great to see you. Mark and I have known each other for, I don't know, about a year and a half, and Mark is a great guy. So thanks for taking the time. I know your time is valuable, and I appreciate you spending it with us and the listeners. So why don't we just start out, maybe you can share a little bit about your own journey, that you've taken in that, you know, in that transition from active to passive. I know you've done some other things professionally. So just give us a little background, share your journey.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks, Scott. Yeah. So actually I'm a chemist by training. As a matter of fact, since we're talking here in Cincinnati, I actually was interviewed for jobs in various chemical industries in the Cincinnati area a bunch of years ago. And at some point in time, I realized that I'm not going to be able to retire if I just go along my chemistry path. And I love the chemistry that I do. It's breakthrough chemistry is just fascinating. So 21 years ago, I got involved in part-time investing. I was an active part-time investor doing mostly flips and rentals, a little bit of lease option as well. And that was really good. I don't want to say that I enjoyed it, but it was extremely important. I would say the most important financial decision I made in my life was to get into single family home investing. And then once I was able to get to the status of accredited investor, which we'll probably talk about a little bit later, I realized I don't have to deal with all the tenants and contractors and code officials and property managers and motivated sellers and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And I can then move into private placement. So that's what I did. I divested out of my rentals and I got into private placements.
All right. So, you know, many people, I think, you know, they think of real estate investing that it's passive, right? I buy a house. And it just sits there and it generates money. But that's not actually the case. And you actually have said it's semi-passive. So explain that to the audience.
Yeah. So, having rentals is I don't want to make a statement. You know, never trust a chemist to talk about finances, but I would say that rentals is probably the best, or not the best. The most securest way of building net worth and also cash flow, but on rentals, they'd say, you know, make money while you sleep, but that's true until something happens. So, for example, let's say a sewer line breaks. Okay, that day it's not passive income. Even and like I never fixed sewer lines, but I've had several of these happen. But I'd have to oversee it. I'd have to, you know, manage the contractors, find the contractors, deal with whatever I would have to deal with. Or if there's going to be an eviction, even if I hire a property manager to take care of it, still, there are decisions to be made, whether it's repairs or evictions or just all kinds of things. Or, of course, I could still hire a property manager, give them 8% of my gross rent, which is about one-third of my total income, you know, my, of my
sure.
Cash flow. So on a good day, rentals are semi-passive. I'm not even talking about wholesaling and flipping that are active. But, you know, you just were talking about rentals and lease options. Those are semi-passive on a good day.
Well, and I'll tell you what, that idea of while you sleep, you earn rent money, that's great, except when they wake you at 3 o'clock in the morning from your sleep to fix that sewer line. It's just... my wife has learned to accept it if it happens, but we don't even get it as much anymore. But you're right. Passive is much – that's truly passive when you don't have to deal with that kind of stuff. So actually
– just to interject, the IRS thinks that it's passive. So
right.
The word passive has sort of migrated from the IRS into the vernacular of real estate investing. But it's passive until it isn't.
Agreed. And actually, even the IRS has different, they use passive different ways in the code. So that doesn't even help. It can be very confusing. So give me an idea of examples of what a truly passive item is, a real estate investment is. And, you know, what is a semi-passive? So give me some examples of that.
Okay, well, I guess a good example, since these are the big people in the audience are mostly in real estate, let's talk about apartment syndications. And so apartment syndications are there are two types of people. There are people that do all the work, and there are people that do none of the work. And I'm part of the people who do none of the work. The people who do all of the work, those are the syndicators or the general partners. And the general partners, I mean, they really do a lot of stuff. I mean, there's actually 20 different categories of activities that they do in pre-acquisition, during acquisition, and during asset management, and during disposition. And they're doing all this stuff. They're managing a lot of things, a lot of people, a lot of activities. And then, and they make really good money, especially if it's a larger apartment complex. I mean, I recommend that there's a course by Anthony Chara. I don't get anything for this, so it's okay if I talk about somebody's course, I think. And I took his course, I don't know, 8 years ago, something like that. It's a great 4-day course where they teach you all the different things. Oh, and I learned a lot from there, because it takes 4 days to learn all the things that have to be done.
Right.
Whereas as a limited partner, I am totally passive. I basically... I find out what the deal is. You know, I get pitched a lot of deals every year, and then I choose a couple or a handful to do a deep due diligence, and then I do my deep due diligence, which is typically between 5 and about 15 hours, which is as much as I used to do a deep due diligence before I would buy a rental or a flip. And then after that, I sign the documents, wire the money, and the money comes in. Some of it comes in as what's called preferred return, which is like cash flow, and others it comes in as growth, which is a big chunk of money at the end. So here we have apartment syndications is one of many, many different types of real estate syndications and private placements, where it's both passive and active, depending on which side you're on. So the active, that's the syndicator doing all the work. Then there's the passive, which is people like me that are just, you know, putting in money after performing deep due diligence to minimize risk, to make sure that everything is good. You know, the jockey is good, the horse is good, the track is good. And so that would be an example where it's both passive and active at the same time. There's really no semi-passive in the middle. Whereas rentals, those are semi-passive, like self-managed rentals or even rentals managed by a property manager. Those are semi-passive.
All right, Mark, we'll continue. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will have a few questions from listeners, and we'll talk more about this passive investing. Welcome back, and we are talking passive investing versus active or semi-active. We have Mark Halpern on the phone, and actually, I wanted to point out, he is actually going to be teaching a class on this Saturday, the 22nd, from 9 to 3 p.m. And that will be Cincinnati RIA. If you want to sign up for that, CincinnatiRIA.com. He's going to go into even greater detail. We've only got, you know, an hour, 45 minutes to go over this. And so we'll definitely need that time. So, Mark, tell me, when I do passive investing, what kind of rates of returns do I get? What's the benefit for me, and maybe how does that compare to some other investments return-wise?
Okay, well, since I'm a chemist, I'm required to tell the truth, and so I'm not gonna try and sugarcoat things. I'm just telling you the way it is. Let me just give you some data from 2024. We just finished 2024, And I looked at the private placements that I had, and I had three exits. So in other words, I have right now, and I talk mostly about what I have in my self-directed Roth 401k because it's asset protected, and I'm not putting a target on my back. In my self-directed Roth 401k right now, I have 12 private placements in 11 sectors with 10 different sponsors. And some of them are, most of them are generating cash flow. And the cash flows are anywhere between, let's say 8%. Okay. So for example, in every $100,000 you put in, you get $8,000 in cash, which doesn't seem like a lot. On the one hand, on the other hand, every once in a while you get exits. Every 3 to 5 years, sometimes 7 years, a private placement will exit. So, you know, if you have 10 or 12 or 15 or 20 of these, you're going to get a few exits per year. So, I had three exits in 2024. One exit was an apartment syndication from 2019, actually, and I had a 37% average annual return, which is pretty good. So in other words, my Roth put in $50,000, and I got $8,000 a year, which is $4,000 a year, which is 8%. But then I also got a chunk of $160,791, I think it was, in a chunk when it sold. Then I had some stuff in land development, which I think is a great asset class for me. I'm not making recommendations for you. I'm just saying it's a great asset class for me. And there I had a 46% IRR. But then I also had a student housing private placement in Florida that had an average annual return of minus 6%. So there's always risk when you're doing private placements, actually when you do anything. Actually, if you're driving on a two-lane highway and you're going 50 miles an hour and somebody else is going 50 miles an hour the other direction, you know, what's separating you and this other person is are two yellow lines that are an eighth of an inch thick. So, you know, there's risk, and the consequences are pretty significant. You could die, or worse yet, your insurance rates could go up. So we really have risk in everything that we do, and that includes private placements. And the way then to minimize your risk and improve your performance is by performing deep due diligence. So what I typically target is I don't really look at anything. I don't look at a private placement unless it has at least a projected 15% internal rate of return, IRR. And I'm usually expecting in the 20 to 40% range, mostly in the 20 to 30% range. But can I guarantee you that? No. Sometimes you lose money.
All right. So as far as trying to mitigate those risks, we know we do have to do diligence, but then you've got some diversification. So maybe you can speak to that, the importance of that diversification.
Yes, exactly. So there are seven different best practices that I do to manage risk, let's call it that. And certainly diversification is one. Like I mentioned earlier, I diversify in three dimensions, which is multiple projects in multiple asset classes with multiple sponsors. So, for example, my Roth 401k these days, and my 401k, by the way, has no stocks in it. My traditional IRA has stocks, but my 401k is all in private placement. So, again, it's 12 projects in 11 sectors with 10 sponsors, and that's one thing. But another thing is sort of common sense. Don't invest more than 5% of your net worth in any single project. And, again, I'm not making a recommendation. I'm just saying these are some of the things that I do. And then there are other, and so in addition to deep due diligence, there are a bunch of things that you can do in terms of diversification, which is really good. And in order to do diversification, sometimes you have to learn new things. Like when I loan money on a NeuroCare facility in Sacramento. Well, I didn't know what a NeuroCare facility is, so I had to learn about, you know, NeuroCare facilities and why there aren't any in Sacramento, why insurance companies love it, and or, you know, the farm in Paraguay that I'm invested in, or a resort in Belize, or a litigation fund for Camp Lejeune. So all these are all different kinds of things that I'm invested in, and they're not, and I try to be as non-correlated as possible. So, which means, you know, not correlated to the stock market, not correlated to the economy, not correlated to real estate, and those sorts of things. So, diversification is a very important component of risk management or portfolio management.
So, where do you typically find the deals? Because I think a lot of listeners would say, "Well, I've got some money." We'll talk a little bit about the after the next break. We'll talk about what it takes to put money in, who's allowed to do it, that kind of stuff. But how would you go about finding these deals? Because I wouldn't know of anybody. The Camp Lejeune Fund, I always saw them commercials, but never found folks that actually funded that. So where do you find these deals?
Okay, well, so what I'm going to do is we don't have a lot of time, but I'll tell you a short story. I was invited by accident to be on stage at an event by the Family Office Club. This was several years ago. I didn't know what family offices were. I didn't even know this was a big deal. I got on stage, and I actually had imposter syndrome when I was up there. But when I spoke, and I got off stage, I apologized for saying, boy, these other people, they have hundreds of millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars. I don't have anywhere near that. And then when I got off stage, all of a sudden, I was getting hit with offerings, with private placement offerings or PPOs. So several years ago, I was maybe seeing 3 to 4 private placement offerings per year. And now, since I've been involved in Family Office Club and Passive Pockets is another place to get these things, is I am now bombarded with 350 to 400 private placement offerings per year.
Wow.
And I'm still a chemist. I mean, I'm a part-time investor.
Hey.
So I actually lead a group of, right now we have more than 60 accredited investors, where we share deal flow and we perform deep due diligence together. But pretty much it's networking because these are private placements. They're not private. People say, tell me a website I can go to get these private placements. Well, they're private. They're not public. So really it's about networking. And that's why, more than 60 of us have gotten together, and we share deal flow. And so there are a variety of places. But pretty much not at the REAs. They're not, the real estate investor associations. They're specialized places like Family Office Club is without question the best.
And I think I'll ask you a question and get back of why they're not at REAs, and I think we'll have that. Well, maybe we have a little bit of time. Why don't we see somebody standing up at REAs saying, "Hey, I've got this great deal. You can make X percent and give all the details." Why doesn't that occur at those meetings?
And that's a good question. I've asked myself that question. As a matter of fact, I was at a REA last night, and I think there's several reasons. First of all, in the REAs, most of the people, I used to be a national speaker on part-time investing, and I went to several REAs, and it's my estimate, and I could be wrong depending on your REA, but about 5 to 10% of REA members are full-time investors. About 40-50% never buy a house. Mm-hmm. And the other 50% are part-time investors like me, like I used to be, mostly doing flips, rentals, a little bit of lease option, and wholesaling. So those are sort of the cookie-cutter kind of things that you can do. A guru will teach you, how to do this. Follow the instructions, do exactly as I say, and that's it. You do what the gurus say, and then you make money. But the best opportunities for private placements, the fortunate or unfortunate situation is the best ones are for accredited investors, which means, I won't go into the entire definition, but the definition that most of us meet that are accredited, it's a net worth of $1 million or more with, and this is correct now in February of 2025, if anybody's listening to this later on, excluding the equity in your primary residence. So a lot of REA members don't have that yet. But if you're a member at a REA and you're just starting out, this is still a really good goal. Why? Because just know that if you don't particularly enjoy interacting all the time with tenants and contractors and code officials and lenders and private borrowers and all this, that one day that there's light at the end of the tunnel. You don't have to do that forever. You just have to do it until you become an accredited investor and you can become a private placement investor. And at REAs, risk management. So a part of private placement investing is risk management is really, really important. Now, it's important in all investing, but it's more important in private placement investing because all the work that I do is the deep due diligence and the risk management, because once that's done, I hand my money over and then – I have to rely on the performance of other people, which is a problem for a lot of people. I want to be in control. Okay.
Right.
All right.
Well, so Mark, we're going to talk more into that accredited investor, how to get it done. Right now we're going to take a break and we'll be right back. All right. We are back here with, Mark Halpern. First, let me just, two events coming up. this Thursday, that would be tomorrow, we have a Fund My Deal night where members of RIAs and groups get together. Cincinnati RIA does it's Cincinnati RIA, and there's a group out of Columbus. The members bring deals, and we're going to have lenders there. If you want to register and submit any potential deals, go to CincinnatiRIA.com, and you can bring that up. Sort of like a mini Shark Tank, I think. so that would be the thing. Then the other thing, definitely, Mark is going to be speaking Saturday from 9 to 3, the 22nd. He's going to be speaking on the roadmap to the passive income endgame. And the reality, and go to CincinnatiRIA.com to register for that. I'm going to give you the phone number and email. Email if you got questions, vinaradio@gmail.com or 877-772-9658. If you want to do it live and be on the radio, that would be great. So what we're going to do now, Mark, is talk a little bit about the whole idea of how much money do I need to do that? You've already talked about we need to be an accredited investor. And I think some maybe don't reach that. We talked about that. They wouldn't. There's not a lot. Maybe the vast majority at the RIA meetings aren't there yet. They're progressing, and it's a great. That's where you want to be, because to be able to be at home and sort of what Mark alluded to before, actually have stuff making money while you sleep, and that is not rentals. That is a great goal. So let's talk about how much money you need. And what do you really need to do to get ready to be investing in passive investments like syndications?
Yeah, very good. Excellent question. The answer that I'll give is based on the experience of what I see syndicators and other kind of private placement offering sponsors are asking for. So typically, most of the private placements that I invest in usually have either a $50,000 minimum or a $100,000 minimum. Some of them have $25,000 minimums, and some are as low as $10,000, but those are usually not the best deals. The sort of the hard cut is in the $50,000, $100,000 range. And by the way, if you don't have $50,000 or $100,000, but you are an accredited investor, you can get together with a bunch of other accredited investors, and as long as you meet the $50,000 or $100,000 minimum, then that's okay. So I'll give you an example. Right now, I'm investing in a medical device company, and my Roth right now has six figures to invest, but I only wanted to put in $30,000, and they have a $100,000 minimum. So a few of us got together, we set up an LLC, and then we're going to be putting our money together. I'm only putting my Roth is only putting in $30,000. So okay. Those are the general kind of numbers that we're talking about. And then when you exit from, you sold a rental that you've been holding on for a while, and it's done some appreciation. I'm not going to talk about taxes here, but instead of flipping it, instead of redeploying the money into the next rental, then you can redeploy it into a private placement. And especially if the rental's in your Roth or your self-directed IRA, which is where I built the seven-figure Roth by starting with flips and rentals in my Roth. And then we had the exits, I moved them to private placements like in land development and things like that.
Great. So so it doesn't it somewhat requires some money, but what's the path for a new investor just trying to make a living and he wants to get into that passive passive investing? I mean, what is a typical path or a good way for an investor who is not quite there yet, but he needs to plan to get there? What's a good strategy for him to path forward?
Yeah, so what I would suggest is the RIAs, you know, the real estate investor associations around the country are really the best place to get started, because you've got mentors, you've got lenders, you've got borrowers, you've got contractors, you've got experienced people that you can be friends with, that you can, someone's just, sharing the name of an electrician or who does the sewer or who, those sorts of things. So I would start the way that I started. Is again my first, my most important financial decision in my life was to get into single-family home real estate investing, active single-family home real estate investing. But then the most important psychological decision I made in my life was to exit single-family home or real estate investing. Now, I can't be where I am today if I did not do the decade or so of really, really slow 1 to 2 houses per year. That's, all I did was 1 to 2 houses per year. That's it. I only bought a total of 16 houses over 11 years. Nobody can do it slower than I did it, okay? And I was through seller's markets and buyer's markets and all kinds of markets. So you can do this in pretty much any market. You just have to adjust your strategy. So what I would say for people that are aspiring to be, let's say, a truly passive investor, what I call the ultimate passive investor endgame, is if you're just starting out, start with the usual flips and rentals. You know, do a flip, take the money from the flip, use it as a down payment for a rental, and then build up some a small portfolio of rentals. I vowed never to ever have more than 10 rentals at a time. I think I maxed out at 9 simultaneously, and then I started divesting out. So I just think that the best way is starting just the classical way that they teach in the RIAs, and then when you get the accredited investor status, that's your magic golden ticket to start doing private placement investing. So that's sort of, and the real strategy, when I look back at those 11 years that I bought those 16 houses, the strategy really that I used is buy, fix, rent, and sell. So it's not flipping and it's not rentals. It's sort of in the middle. I would buy, you know, houses in really bad shape that were very low, turn them into palaces. So that's buy and fix. But then I would rent it, and I could afford, because I always had the best quality rental at the price point, and also flips at the price point. Then I was able to get the best tenants. And then I would wait for the market to change. It could have taken 2 years, it could have taken 7 years, it could have taken 12 years, whatever it would take. And then when the market, when you see that appreciation, then you say, you know what, I really have I have some great equity here. And something that I never heard anybody talk about RIAs, but I always tracked, is cash on equity return. So I'm not going to go into that now. If we have time on Saturday, maybe I'll go into that. Cash and equity return is a great way of trying to figure out if you're leveraging your equity, not your cash, but if you're leveraging your equity in the most efficient way. And when your cash and equity return goes down to a certain level, you can then redeploy your equity. And then once you get to accredited investor status, then now you're off to the races. You can start doing family office club stuff like I do, and then live the life by design, which is the life that I live right now, with private placement investing, which I absolutely love.
So we have a question. we have a couple questions we're going to go to now. So one, I've got SK, and he's actually in the Rocky Mountains, Colorado. So probably lots more snow than there is in Ohio right now, but still, it is cold here. I'm sure chilly there. So he says, I'm trying to continue to expand in passive investing, but I've had mixed luck, including bad in all caps, with syndications. Any thoughts on holding the mortgage on a property versus a note or a partial? What do you think from a passive side?
Yeah, so that's a great, great question. It's a very practical question, a very timely question, because since the Fed started raising rates, or since they raised rates at an unprecedented pace and magnitude between March of 2023 and July of it was March of 2022 to July of 2023, then a lot of syndications are in trouble. And because I performed deep due diligence, I was able to, and I was extremely selective in, you know, the deep due diligence, again, on the jockey, the horse, and on the track, I was able mostly to avoid those problems. So I think deep due diligence is really important. But when it comes to note investing, on Saturday workshop, I'm going to be comparing certain characteristics of the 7 top real estate investment strategies, the 4 active ones, which are rentals, flipping, wholesaling, and lease option, and then the 3 passive ones, or semi-passive, the 3 mostly passive ones, which are private lending, note investing, and private placements. So holding a note is fine. So either note investing or private lending, those are, they're related a little bit, but they're different. If you're willing to go with certain types of of returns that are less than in private placements, and you're still willing, because even in those cases, you still have to manage the borrowers in that case. And every once in a while, you know, might have to go to foreclosure. I was a private lender from 2001 to 2011, and I foreclosed. I foreclosed on the estate of a 35-year-old flipper who died in the middle of the project. So, and his girlfriend was collecting money from other people. It was really a very interesting situation. So, I mean, private lending works. Actually, all of these strategies work. It's just a question of what is the ratio between money and psychological freedom, which means not having to manage people, among other things.
So let's talk a little bit about that, because you've mentioned that before, psychological freedom. Sort of maybe dig a little deeper into that. We just have a few minutes for that.
Sure. So as you, the audience doesn't know this, I've written 7 books. I've written 4 on chemical technology. I've written 2 on real estate investing, and I've written 1 on happiness. Why is this even relevant? Because in 2007, I invented the first objective metric for happiness. And more recently, I have a book called Now Be Happier that's available. And what I concluded is happiness is all about what you do with your time. And the goal for happiness, I've been able to distill it into one very simple sentence, which is the goal for happiness is to maximize the number of seconds you enjoy without causing harm from now to end of life. So if there have been billions of years before we were born and there are billions of years after we die and we have about 100 years or less, we want to maximize the number of seconds we enjoy without causing harm between now and end of life. So psychological freedom for me is maximizing those number of seconds that I enjoy. And the more that I had tenants and contractors and code officials and motivated sellers and all that kind of stuff, the less I was enjoying seconds of my life. So psychological freedom for me is, and I'll get to some more definition in the Saturday workshop, but psychological freedom for me is not having to manage any humanoid life forms. I manage a portfolio, right, but I don't manage people. And I'm reasonably good at managing people, but I don't particularly enjoy it. So psychological freedom for me, and it's not just enough psychological freedom. It has to be simultaneous financial and psychological freedom. So, you know, you want to be making, you know, passive income of at least $10,000 a month or whatever your number is, or $100,000 a year in increase in net worth. But, you know, no doors owned or managed, no marketing, no sales, no management of other people. And also one other thing about psychological freedom is legacy. And I've seen this happen to several people. You know, they build these portfolios with 20 rentals, 30 rentals, 70 rentals. I know one guy with 150 rentals. And then they pass away. Their kids are not interested in managing all these rentals.
Right.
So a major advantage for private placement investing, and because my kids are adults, is and I have a Dropbox file. Something happens to me, they go to the Dropbox file. Everything is there, and everything is passive. They basically can, you know, they can grieve over me for 15 microseconds, and then with my because everything of course goes also to my trust. We won't go into all the legal stuff of all this, and they don't have to manage tenants, contractors, or anybody.
You do want them to cry at your funeral, though, right?
You want to make sure. Frankly, since I'm not gonna be there to see it, they can actually do what they want.
They can just have a party. Just don't count the money at the funeral. Anyway, but that's good. I love that definition of happiness. I think that is a great definition, great way to gauge that. So we're going to take a break, but call if you have any questions, 877-772-9658 or vinaradio@gmail.com. And we are back with Mark Halperin. And so we are going to continue talking about passive investing, the true sort of end game where you can have your money working for you and you don't have to work for your money. Mark, we got a question from Cameron. He says, you know, how did you handle, so you went from rentals, right, and you moved into syndications. You were obviously a part-time investor. You had a job. But how did you handle the tax implications of selling those rentals off to then have the funds to invest?
Right. That's probably one of the most difficult barriers to overcome. And I was actually in the National RIA Cruise a couple of weeks ago, and there was a guy there that his net worth is probably somewhere around $25 million, and he's not selling because of all the taxes, you know, depreciation, recapture, and all the things. But I don't think his family is really thrilled with all the work that they're doing to manage all these rentals and this commercial real estate in it as well. So I would say like this. I'm going to give you a very imperfect answer. The imperfect answer is to try as much as possible to do it the way that I did it. Once I realized that taxes are going to be a really big issue, I set up a self-directed 401k and I set up a self-directed Roth 401k. Actually, I set it up in 2007, and I slowly built it, you know, one deal at a time. I did some flips, not more than one a year. I'm not going to go into all the what's allowed and what's not allowed, but I would do a flip, and I'm going to, again, I don't mean to overly play the Saturday workshop, but in the Saturday workshop, I'm going to show an example, and maybe I'll even describe it right now, of a track, which is I did a flip in my self-directed Roth 401k. I invested $82,000 of Roth money, which took me a while to accumulate, and then I redeployed that into a rental that I held for 4.5 years. It was 5.5 years. I don't remember exactly. When I see the slides, I'll know. And then the $82,000 turned into a $293,000 of tax-free money over those 5.5 years. Now, that's just two transactions, right? One flip and one rental. And then out of the $293,000, I took $250,000, and I moved it into a private placement at a low rate, which was 12%, which was generating $2,500 a month of positive cash flow. Again, all this is tax-free. So if you can, if you're young enough to do this, and when I say young enough, I mean, I'm not going to tell you my age right now, but I was doing a lot of this in my 50s and 60s, okay? And so if you can start in a Roth, that's the absolute I can't say that's the absolute best. I submit for your consideration, because I don't want to give legal advice or tax advice, because, you know, don't take tax advice from a chemist, but I submit for your consideration that starting early, as early as possible, and I was like 53 when I started this, my self-directed Roth 401k, then you don't have to deal with the tax consequences. And on Saturday, I'm going to talk about one stupid thing which I did, where I bought a flip and then I did a rental in my self-directed pre-tax 401k, and I probably owe, I don't know, well over $100,000 in taxes when and if I'm going to take that out one day. I should have done a Roth conversion, but that's a whole other story. So my first recommendation is try to do as much as possible in a self-directed 401k, a Roth 401k. But let's say you don't have that, okay? Let's say you've already, you know, you've got your 30 rentals and you're, you know, 48 years old and it's using regular money. It is going to be tough to rip off that Band-Aid and pay the taxes. And, you know, long-term capital gains rates are still reasonable. There's another partial answer. If you're doing 1031 exchanges, which I'll just mention very briefly in a moment, you can actually I strongly submit for your consideration that you speak with a licensed CPA about this, that you can do a 1031 exchange into real estate that's in a DST, a Delaware statutory trust. And there are things like that out there. For example, the NeuroCare facility that we have in Sacramento is a DST, and you can put in small amounts. You can put in even millions of dollars into one of those. I will tell you that I'm biased against a 1031 exchange because the strategy is defer, and die. And I don't mind deferring, but as much as I love my kids, I'm not willing to die just so they can have a tax break. I'm very selfish like that.
There you go. Well,
so to summarize, either self-directed 401k, Roth, or self-directed IRA, Roth IRA, or roll it into a DST, a 1031 exchange, or bite the bullet, rip off the Band-Aid, because once you have psychological freedom, it's like I can try to describe to you what it's like to have psychological freedom, simultaneous psychological and financial freedom, but you have to experience it. It's a beautiful life.
Let's talk a little bit about the the idea of investing in syndications, truly passive, out of your Roth or traditional 401k or IRA, and what makes that what makes syndications ideal for that? I do a lot of valuations of syndication investments, and there's just a lot of people use their retirement accounts. So what are some of the pluses, and what are some of the minuses of investing out of your retirement account?
Great question. And before I go further, Scott, I need to tell you that I have right now it's $100,000 investment from my pre-tax 401k in a litigation fund, and I'm going to probably talk to you about doing a discounted valuation Roth conversion, so
there
I can see if I can convert that $100,000 at a much lower value and then get the benefit when it exits, and which
right.
can be really, really great.
And that is a whole, that is a whole nother topic of a benefit of investing out of your retirement accounts. And but as for another, we don't have enough time for that. We have about 5 more minutes left.
Okay.
So let's let's talk about some benefits of doing them in the retirement accounts, and let's talk a little bit about the minus, which can be the UBIT problem.
Oh, okay. Believe it or not, I want to start with the minus and the UBIT problem.
Okay.
Maybe I'll start with the advantages. If you're talking about Roth. If we ignore this UBIT thing for a moment, I just don't see any disadvantage. The growth, when you're not taking money off the table all the time, and you never have to take money off the table, having a Roth is just, it's amazing. It just, the growth is phenomenal. And once you become 59 and a half, and I'm older than 59 and a half, you can just take this money out, you fill out what's the 1099-R at the...
Yeah,
box seven is whatever it is, and then you just take the money. It's really, really cool, and that's really good. So I mean, the tax free growth, the tax free income, is truly amazing, and it's so obvious. I don't even want to waste any time on it. It's really, really great.
Right.
Let's talk about UBIT now, and again, don't take tax advice or from a chemist, but the reason why I started a 401k. Back in 2007, instead of an IRA, there were seven reasons, but the two biggest reasons was one, I was able to ramp it up much, much faster. But another one, which is still today, which is really weird, I don't understand Congress. Of course, I never understand Congress. Nobody does. That's right. If they did, actually, that would be interesting if they could understand that. There are different types of UBIT, and one type of UBIT, which is people don't talk about that much, is the tax that you have to pay when a retirement plan or other types of entities like charities, when they are using when they buy operating businesses. But in real estate, we're not talking about operating businesses. These are recognized. I think it's Section 512 of the code, but I believe it or not, I've actually read, because I'm crazy, I'm emotionally disturbed. But if you have a 401k, a self-directed 401k. So self-directed 401k does not have to pay the part of UBIT called UDFI, which is unrelated debt-financed income.
Yeah.
And so IRAs have to pay that, 401ks don't.
Correct.
So my Roth 401k simply doesn't pay taxes on the UBIT unless I were to buy an operating business, which I don't do. And so that disadvantage goes away. But even if you have to pay, UBIT, you sort of need to sit down with a spreadsheet. The devil here is in the details, and you take a look. People say, oh, I don't want to pay tax, I want to pay tax. Okay, well, what if you're making a boatload, such a big boatload of money that you have to pay some tax on it, and what you're left with is a slightly smaller boatload?
Exactly.
Do the math.
Yep.
It's not even math, it's arithmetic.
I agree. So we do have some questions, which we're not going to be able to get to. I apologize. We have just run out of time. This is Marcus. You've been awesome. Due diligence questions. I encourage you. He will cover more of that on Saturday, the 22nd, this Saturday, 9 to 3. Go to CincinnatiRIA.com to sign up for that. And Mark, you got about 60 seconds. If someone's on the fence about making the transition to passive investing, what would you say to them? 60 seconds.
Do the arithmetic. Do the arithmetic on the finances. And when it comes to the happiness part, just try to remember, if you want to accept what I'm saying, that the goal in life, the goal for happiness, is to maximize the number of seconds you enjoy without causing harm. So if you're looking for more happiness, then I think that's a good way of doing it. And again, I'm not trying to advertise here, but if you want to learn more about the happiness, you can go to nowbehappier.com. Or if you want to go to the part-time investors, you can go to parttimeinvestors.com, and you can learn more about these things. But I will tell you, it's a great life. So if you're on the fence, do the arithmetic on your happiness first and on your finances, and that's the way to do it.
Well, Mark, thank you so much. We appreciated your time, and we'll see everybody next week.